I'll switch to English because we have also some English-speaking guests today. So I have the pleasure to welcome Professor Benjamin Schütz today from the University of Bremen, and also to give you a quick introduction into his CV and research areas. So Benjamin studied psychology at the Free University of Berlin, where he also finished his PhD in 2007 on health behavior change. After that, he spent a few months as postdoc at the Jacobs University of Bremen, where he also worked together already with Britta Renner. Then he switched back to Berlin to the German Center for Gerontology, where he was a postdoctoral researcher from 2007 to 2011. And after that, he made a quite exotic move. He went to Tasmania, to the University of Tasmania in Australia, where he took a position as associate professor at the School of Medicine. But then Germany was lucky to get Benjamin back in 2017. He took the professorship for public health with focus on health promotion and prevention at the University of Bremen. And Benjamin is without doubt a great speaker with a huge scientific network. His research interests are health promotion and prevention of diseases, health behavior, and social inequality. And in one of his current projects, he also investigates determinants of adherence to behavioral recommendations and psychological adaptation to COVID-19. And yeah, I'm looking very much forward to getting a first insight into this project in the talk. Thanks a lot for following our invitation to speak today, Benjamin. And yeah, the floor is yours.
Excellent. Thank you so much for having me. In the olden days, when I would actually be in Konstanz, I could compliment you on what a nice city that is and how lovely the Bodensee is. The good thing is I don't have to do that right now because Bremen is also quite nice. But of course, Konstanz is lovely. And I'd love to have a dip in the lake afterwards. Our lake here is riddled with blue algae, so I'd rather not do that. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much actually for forcing me to get a bit of our act together. So I really love these invitations because it forces one to put together seemingly disparate pieces of research or seemingly disparate pieces of work and then realize actually it is not that disparate. It is actually, or maybe that's only me, so you'll find out whether it is disparate and whether it is interesting at all. Rightio, I hope you can see that. So I'm going to talk about behavioral recommendations to curb the COVID-19 pandemic and about some individual situational and structural determinants. This is a rough outline of what I'm going to talk about today. So first of all, I'm going to give you a very, very, very brief overview of what behavioral recommendations actually means. And then I'll try to outline multiple levels on which the determinants of those behaviors can be organized, which also gives an idea or which also specifies entry points for the effects of structural and environmental determinants. And then I'll go through some example studies that look at sort of interplays between individual level determinants of adherence on both psychological and socio-structural level. We're going to look at some meso-level determinants, so on determinants on social and situational level. And I'm going to give an outlook on macro-level determinants, which are mainly structural and temporal, but as I said, that's an outlook. We're not quite there yet. And it's mainly going to be time series, so it probably sounds grander than it actually is. I'll start with some behavioral recommendations, and I've stolen that one from the current PR campaign from our university asking warum, so why. The university's question is, why was the university funded 50 years ago? And they have a couple of really good answers, but I find the warum question a really good one to ask for a lot of the research that we're into. So warum or why should we care about behavioral recommendations to curb the COVID pandemic now that we have a couple of vaccines, now that there's at least some developments in terms of therapeutics? Well, behavioral recommendations, which are sort of part of non-pharmaceutical interventions to curb the COVID pandemic are key tools to reduce infections and will continue to be really important even in the face of growing number of vaccinated people and improved therapy measures, because as you've probably heard today, there is an increasing number of proportions of new COVID variant infections that will continue to entertain us. So non-pharmaceutical interventions will continue to be really important. And understanding, and these non-pharmaceutical interventions, and many people also consider lockdowns as part of non-pharmaceutical interventions, of course, have massive adverse socioeconomic and social side effects, which is why adherence to those recommendations is of key importance, and understanding adherence. So understanding adherence to non-pharmaceutical interventions also requires understanding of adherence behavior. These non-pharmaceutical interventions are effective. So there's a couple of systematic reviews and a couple of studies that pool data from different countries that show that the proportions of for example, see the proportion of change in new cases depending on these non-pharmaceutical interventions, such as cancelling public events, restrictions on private gatherings, school closures and workplace closures. With school closures, we're not quite clear of whether that is actually an effect of closed schools or the inability of parents to go to work. So school closures imply, of course, more than just closed schools. But we can see that these non-pharmaceutical interventions are effective in reducing infections. And that particular study here also shows that if these are in place, there are no add-on effects of restrictions of internal movement or of closing of public transport. So adhering to these non-pharmaceutical interventions is of importance for their effectiveness. Also, non-pharmaceutical intervention, if you will, is, for example, wearing face masks in particular. And that is what a very recent study by Cheng and colleagues showed under both virus-rich and virus-limited environments. The difference is mainly related to that N95, which is the Chinese FFP2 standard, is more effective in virus-rich environments, but most of the time we're not in those virus-rich environments. And as you can see here, all of these masks are really effective in reducing the number of emitted particles up the size of 10 microns. So that is smaller than the size of most viruses. So all of these masks are very effective at reducing the emission of particles of that size, both by when sneezing, coughing, speaking, or breathing. So both surgicals and FFP2 masks are really important. You just have to wear them. How does wearing actually look like? Actually, not too bad. So this is self-reported adherence behavior to wearing face masks over the course of the pandemic. That's data from the COSMOS study. And there is quite a bit of variation in adherence behavior, as you can see here. So this is plotted by in how far people agree to the measures. So people who are more accepting of those measures are more likely to wear masks. People who are less likely to wear masks. So there is variation in that behavior, and there's variation that is likely due to variables such as attitudes, but also that was actually meant to be a plot where I've plotted East versus West Germany, or Eastern versus Western Bundesländer, but it would have looked the same. There's variation in COVID protective behavior of not participating in private gatherings. So point is, these are behaviors that are suited or that are suitable to curb infections or new infections with the SARS-CoV-2 virus. But there is sufficient or substantial variation in adhering to those recommendations. Now, as I said before, if we want to understand those differences, we need an understanding of the determinants of those kinds of behaviors. And this is where I'd like to introduce multiple levels of determinants. As psychologists, we are traditionally pretty good, or we at least pretend and would like to think that we are really good at knowing what's going on in here, right? So we're really good at understanding attitudes, at understanding risk perceptions, at understanding interactions of attitudes and different facets of personality. We're really good at discussing whether it's 3, 5, 7, or 39 different factors that describe personality. We're really pretty good at that stuff. We're also sort of good at including sort of the immediate context. So in social interactions, what's going on in our everyday lives. So we're pretty good at that. But there is more than that. So the idea here is that individuals are embedded in different contexts, and contexts on multiple levels. So it doesn't really matter how many levels there are, doesn't really matter how you want to call them. These are just three levels. There might be many, many more levels. These might be different for different behaviors. The idea, however, is crucial. So there is stuff that happens just around us, or that interacts immediately with us, both on a social and on an environmental level. Then there's a larger level around that. So these things that interact with us are organized on levels of, say, organizations, workplaces, schools. This is embedded in even larger contexts, say, communities, Bundesländer, countries, time, whatever. And none of that is new, of course. So these are not new ideas, but I think they're very interesting ideas. So you might remember something like that, ecological systems theory from Uri Bronfenbrenner in developmental psychology, where the assumption is that over time, individuals interact with micro, meso, exo, and macro systematic structures. And in Bronfenbrenner's system, Bronfenbrenner's theory, the microsystem consists of things like family, health services, peer, school. The mesosystem is also things like workplaces. Exosystem is social services, local politics, mass media, and then attitudes and ideologies of the culture and so on. So there's a couple more levels, but a very similar idea of an individual interacting with their environment on multiple levels. And in thinking about the determinants of health, you might have stumbled across the Dahlgren and Whitehead rainbow model of the determinants of health. I could have, while I'm talking about it, I realize I could have chosen an actual rainbow, because there's colors in that as well, but black and white will have to do for now. Very similar idea as well. There's constitutional factors, as they call it. So individual level determinants of health, lifestyle factors, then there's social and community networks, and then what they call living and working conditions, unemployment, water, education. And then there's general socioeconomic, cultural, and environmental conditions. One of the interesting things is that we can think about resources, barriers, and social inequality happening on all of these levels. So there's inequality determined by individual factors such as educational attainment or income. There's inequality that is determined or that is enacted by differences in social and community networks. There's inequalities in access to education, in access to workplaces, in structure and health risks of workplaces, and so on and so on. These multiple levels need to be, and that's sort of where we come from here, these need to be taken into account when we think about determinants of behavior. Now, let's look at some examples for that, and in particular, how socioeconomic status interacts with some individual levels determinants of adherence. For that, we need to do a little excursion into how we traditionally deal with factors such as socioeconomic status in health psychology and in health behavior theories. This is a very generic health behavior theory. There's no claim that it is that there is all variables in there, but all of them, or many of them, follow a very similar structure. If you go from the right to the left, behavior is explained by proximal factors. Most often they're things like self-regulation or motivation or intentions or goals or action plans. Indicators of a proximal likelihood of engaging in that behavior. That's either because you've made a detailed plan or because your motivation is directed at enacting that behavior. And that motivation in turn is predicted and dependent on different health cognitions, be that attitudes or outcome expectations or self-efficacy expectations or risk perception. So a number of cognitions that impact on intermediary variables such as motivation and so on and so on. And traditionally, in theories like the theory of plant behavior, more distal factors are assumed to be mediated through those cognitions. So factors such as socioeconomic status, environmental variables, or personality variables are assumed to be mediated by those cognitions. That means if you are, for example, older, the idea is your age is related to differences in, say, your attitudes. If you are older, you become, for example, more conservative, or if you're older, you're less likely to think that roller skating is a really good idea, so your attitudes to roller skating would differ from those from a younger person. And the idea is that those differences in that cognition explain the difference in age that might be observable in behavior. Or differences in educational attainment might be reflected in attitudes towards healthy nutrition. For example, if you've got higher educational attainment, you have better knowledge of healthy food. So you know how to spell quinoa and you know how to cook vegetarian meals. So you have potentially more positive attitudes towards a healthier nutrition. With lower educational attainment, you might have more negative attitudes towards that. And those differences in attitudes in turn determine your motivation to engage in healthy nutrition, and that explains the differences observable in behavior. So the idea is those distal factors are all mediated or all reflected in differences in those kinds of cognitions. But that might be a bit too simplistic. So that's not necessarily the case. Plus, what is that inequality and socioeconomic status thing anyway? So traditionally in psychology, we have treated that as a nuisance variable or as a variable that needs to be controlled. So you might have run analysis yourself where you control for sex or education or income, but there are explanatory variables as well. They can work as explanatory variables, and I will show you a couple of examples of how they can actually add to our understanding of what's going on with psychological variables, also in the case of COVID. So what is that inequality in socioeconomic status thing anyway? That's a lot of that's a big question, and there's a lot of indicators that can be used for that. Is that relevant? Yes, it is relevant. This is the development in income inequality in Germany. So you can see that the Gini coefficient, which ranges between 0 and 100, has increased not dramatically between 2009 and 2019. So from 29.1 to 29.7. 2005, it was actually at 25, so it has increased quite a bit over over that period of time, and it has had levels up to 31. Still, that is compared to other countries, it is not that high an inequality indicator, but it is rising. And as colleagues of you in Konstanz have recently shown, Germans potentially are particularly bad at estimating the degree of income inequality. So this shows that that people in Germany think that the actual income bracket is a lot smaller than it actually is. So the income ladder on the left, in people's perception on the right, is a lot more compressed. So people perceive the income differences in Germany to be much smaller than they actually are. So we think we're egalitarian, but we're actually not. So there is increasing inequality in Germany. So that is going to be increasingly important as well. Here is a suggestion for operationalizing inequality in health research from the Cochrane Collaboration on Inequality, the Progress Plus Framework. So these are dimensions of inequality, which in health research, in particular in the effects of interventions on health outcomes, have shown to be important. The acronym PROGRESS PLUS stands for P is place of residence, so that means rural, urban, or particular states or provinces, but also housing characteristics. R stands for ethnicity or race. O is occupation and employment status. G is gender, male, female, or other. R is religion. E, education. S is social capital. S is socioeconomic position, and with that they are mainly relating to income, wealth, and other measures. And then there's plus dimensions such as age, disability, sexual orientation, or other factors that delineate being in a vulnerable group or not. Now, what these dimensions have partially, at least in common, is that these dimensions determine access to resources or barriers to resources, such as information or financial support or things like that. So all of these dimensions might impact on the effects of health interventions, and they might do that with different mechanisms. In a systematic review from a while back, where we have pulled estimates of the relationships between intention and physical activity, we showed that the effects of intentions on physical activity, or the correlations between intentions and physical activity, was substantially higher in studies with samples with higher educational attainment as compared to studies with samples with lower educational attainment. So the correlation between intention and physical activity differs between people from with lower or higher educational attainment. So that might seem like a very academic sort of distinction in the first place. Why should we care? And the effects are not even that big. Now, remember that in particular, intentions are key, or at least in most of the behavioral theories, are key determinants of behavior. And most of the interventions that are being employed based on health psychological theory also aim at changing motivation, aim at changing intentions. And then that actually makes a difference, because it means that those interventions, even if they're succeeding in increasing individual intentions, might work or might get different effects depending on educational level. So I've brought the bearing that idea in mind, that these variables from the Progress Plus framework might actually affect the relationships or the effects of psychological variables on behavior. We might look at whether we see different or similar effects for COVID protective behaviors. I'm going to show you some results from a paper we have just submitted that's based on UK data. So I'm acknowledging the support of my dear colleagues from the University of Leeds and the University of Sheffield. So Mark Connor, Andy Prestwich, Sarah Wilding, Rana Al-Khwatan, and Paul Norman, who have run that study with us. And that study looks at predictors of behavior based on the reasoned action approach, going to show that in a minute, very briefly. And in addition to that, perceived susceptibility. So the idea being we're testing different COVID protective behaviors. We're testing how well variables from the reasoned action approach plus perceived susceptibility can explain engagement in those behaviors. And then we test whether those relationships differ based on socio-structural factors. Why is that important? Well, it's important because public health information and measures are often based on those cognitions, and we know that there's social and structural differences in the adherence to COVID protective behaviors, such as wearing face masks and keeping social distance. This is the theoretical background. This is sort of an extended theory of planned behavior, the reasoned action approach, that sort of, and the main extension with regards to the theory of planned behavior is here that in addition to perceived behavioral control, actual control is assumed to mediate the both the relationships between intention and behavior, and it is related to the levels of perceived behavioral control. Other than that, it's very similar to theory of planned behavior. Behavior is predicted by intentions and perceived behavioral control. Intention, in turn, are predicted by perceived behavioral control, perceived norms, attitudes towards the behavior, and those, in turn, are relying on behavioral beliefs, normative beliefs, and control beliefs. And as you can see here, this is where usually the effect of background factors is located. So the idea is that is a fully there's a full mediation of the effects of those background factors through beliefs, attitudes, norms, and perceived behavioral control. What we're doing in this study is that we're taking these background factors and see whether those background factors are modifying the relationship between intentions and behavior and control concepts from the reasoned action approach. The study is based on a prolific sample. That was roughly 500 people. So we had 500 people at the beginning, 477 that took part at two measurement points. With key variables, they were roughly representative of the UK population, 51% female, 15% non-white, and 35 years average age. That's a bit younger than the UK average. And we had indicators of socioeconomic status with the index of multiple deprivation that is based on the postcode area that someone lives in and takes into account a number of indicators such as local unemployment, local average income, and I think local ethnic composition as well. We have ethnicity and we have education attainment. I've put longitudinal in inverted commas because it's only a 14 days interval. There's also people who call that kind of research shortitudinal, which I think is an appropriate description. And what we did, because we studied a number of COVID protective behaviors, we took a within-person approach in which behaviors are nested under participants. This is the general idea. We examined whether the effects of cognitions of on behavior were moderated by socioeconomic status. Now, that study examined a number of COVID protective behaviors, as I said before. So this it was examining washing hands, wearing face masks, keeping 1.5 meters distance, only leaving the house for shopping, not attending private gatherings, and a couple of others which I should have written down but forgotten. So in total, we were looking at 8 protective behaviors. And if you run regression analyses, which are implied by that kind of model, so predicting behavior from cognitions with an interaction term for SES indicators, you run into about 90 different regression models. And as you all know, with adjusting for multiple testing, that becomes very uninformative and very uninteresting as well. On the other hand, these behaviors are related to each other. So all of these behaviors have the goal of protecting and preventing COVID behaviors. So we're actually looking at an approach where we pool the relationships of cognitions and behaviors within persons. So one person, aptly named person one here, provided us with information on their engagement in behavior X, say wearing a face mask, behavior Y, say keeping a social distance, and behavior Z, say going out for shopping only. And these are predicted from cognition X. Intention to wear a face mask, intention to be socially distant, or intention to go out for shop for the shops only. If we do that with a number of persons, so say two people here, the idea is cognitions and behaviors would have moved together, and then the idea is we get within-person correlations between cognitions and behavior, and these are determined by the relationships between eight cognitions and eight behaviors in person one. So you compute an effect of cognitions on behavior in person one from those eight behaviors, and in person two, and so on and so on. So you get pooled, so you get correlation coefficients or regression coefficients within people, within persons, and then you can examine whether differences in those regression coefficients between people are due to a between-person variable, such as indicators of socioeconomic status. So this is a hierarchical linear model, or a multi-level regression model, and that implies a cross-level interaction between person-level variables on level two, like education attainment, and behavior-level relationship on level one. And what we found were a couple of really interesting interaction effects, such as these. So for illustration, I'm going to show you these two. Okay, on the left-hand side, you can see the probability of engaging in protective behaviors. And not very surprising, engaging in COVID protective behaviors is less likely if people have low intentions, and it is more likely if people have high intentions. However, as you can also see, that relationship differs by deprivation index. So those who are less deprived, that is people with higher income, are better at translating their intentions into behavior. And at the same time, that is on the right-hand side, we can see that variables such as perceptions of autonomy can buffer effects of deprivation. So probability of behavior is higher in those from less deprived backgrounds or low deprivation. The dotted line, their probability is higher, but the difference between high and low deprivation gets smaller as perceptions of autonomy increase. Which means on the one hand side, deprivation is related to the potential of acting on intentions, and on the other hand, perceptions of autonomy, perceptions of being able to do stuff, is buffering detrimental effects of deprivation. So why would we care about that? So I'm bringing back our warum picture here, and as I said before, many of the interventions we're working with are geared towards increasing individual motivation to act. So most of the time, interventions based on health psychological theories and interventions in mass media and campaigns aim at increasing information or improving access to information, with the idea, well, if people know well enough why that's good for them, they might do that. And even if they know why it's good for them, that's what our data shows, even if they're motivated to do something, the chances of them actually doing something is dependent on those structural factors, deprivation, for example. In public health, we call those things equity effects of interventions, or of behavior change interventions. So there's a couple of conceptual figures that outline why that is an important thing to look at. So this is what we know. There's a difference, or there's a gap, let's call it the health gap, between those who are best off and those who are worst off. Means those who have lower education, lower access to resources, their health is worse, or their health behavior is worse. Those who have better access have better health and engage in more health behaviors. Now, if we conduct an intervention that works well, we might get equal effects. Yes. So the health of those who are worst off improves, and the health of those who are best off improves as well. In that case, equal effect. So the slope of the improvement in health is constant, is the same, and the health gap remains constant, which is not bad, but it also means that those who are best off or were best off are still best off. These are what I call equitable effects. So with the ideal that the health gap closes, in that case, health of both groups improves, but the improvement is bigger in the group of those who are worst off, so they can catch up, and the health gap closes, which would be a very desirable outcome. However, this is what happens quite often. The health gap widens because those who are best off to start off with profit more from interventions than those who are worst off. And our results suggest something not too dissimilar. So if we increase intentions in interventions that build on informing people, then it's only those who have the necessary resources who will profit from that, because they have the resources to translate those intentions into actual behavior. Now, let's go a bit further. Let's look at some social and situational level influences on health behaviors. So we're moving on from sort of here to what is around us and what we are encountering. And I'm going to show you a bit of stuff from a current project we are doing with the group for human-computer interaction at the University of Bremen. And that is concerned with curbing the spread of misinformation on social media. So we're looking at determinants of misinformation sharing behavior and whether there's a potential for nudging interventions based on that. And I'd like to acknowledge everyone who's working on that, with Johannes Schöning, the head of the HCI group at the University of Bremen, the person who has actually pulled that grant from the Volkswagen Stiftung. Also Christopher, Daniel, Tina, Rihanna and Sarah, who are supporting our work on that. That is an ongoing project. I'm going to give you a brief idea of what the actual conceptual ideas are, and then drift a bit further into a part of a smaller project related to it where we actually have some results to show. What with the background? And remember that the idea is that these disinformation and misinformation snippets of news are things that we encounter in our everyday environments on social media. One important distinction is that between disinformation and misinformation. So disinformation is information that is wrong, and it is information that is intended to deceive. So it's grossly wrong information that has the intention of making you do stuff that you wouldn't do otherwise. And it's a relatively small share of shared false information. The bigger share is misinformation, that is stuff that is being put in the wrong context or not necessarily intended to deceive. And that is a much bigger share of false information on social media. So it's not outright lies, but it is things that are being put in the wrong context or that give the wrong impression by the context is being put in. The problem of those misinformation and disinformation has been dubbed the infodemic, and the WHO said that the overabundance of information, some is accurate and some not, that makes it hard for people to find trustworthy sources and reliable guidance. They call that the infodemic. And the problem that is emerging from that is that the inaccurate information and overwhelming amount of information is actually detrimental to adherence to guidelines, because it means you can get lots of different opinions that are seemingly equally valid, and that all might contradict each other, so you end up with not really knowing what you need to do. What we're trying to do in this project is that we're not necessarily looking at the content of fake news and false information. There's people who are much, much better than we are at doing that. and at mapping that on topics and things like that. But what we think is, or has been missing so far, is understanding sharing misinformation as a behavior, and in particular also as a social behavior. So misinformation sharing is not necessarily a byproduct of low knowledge or low literacy, but it is behavior that is enacted within specific contexts, and specific contextual properties are therefore essential. For example, sharing misinformation on the web might have social implications. So even if people know that that information they're going to share is most likely false, they might still think it is entertaining, and they're sending that out to entertain their friends, or they're sharing it to entertain friends, or they're sharing it to signal a specific social function of the behavior, so of the message. So sharing that message puts them into a specific light, and they're sort of signaling, this is what I think, or this is, by sharing this, I show that this is sort of my opinion. And if it is contextual, or because it is contextual, that also means we need to look at fast reactive and implicit processes, so reactions to stimuli, essentially, which is where also nudging comes into place. And it is, of course, something that is relatively complex and multi-determined, and that the determinants interact. If we apply that to contextual information interventions, and there's a couple of those out there at the moment, then most of those so far have built on augmenting user contexts or user feeds by asking, get the facts on mail-in ballots. So that particular Twitter user has been asked to get their facts right about mail-in ballots. I don't think that they have taken that opportunity. But that relies on fact-checking or linking trustworthy information and flagging false information. What that does is that relies on active information processing of the person who is about to share something. What we want to do is in that project is, on the one hand, we're conducting a systematic review at the moment, where we're trying to systematically assess and categorize the existing evidence of determinants of sharing behavior, and then classify those by the theoretical domains framework, because that would allow us to then map specific evidence-based determinants of behavior change and behavior change techniques onto those domains, which is one of the things where the behavior change wheel might come in really handy. And one of the ideas is that we would try to develop a nudging-based intervention, and there is a specific framework for technology-mediated nudges out there, which is relatively popular in the human-computer interaction literature, and evaluate an experimental vignette study in which we provide people with disinformation and misinformation, maybe also a bit of correct information, and see under which circumstances they choose to share that or not, in comparison, in combination with a number of potential nudges, because those would then sort of support that fast processing, because it wouldn't rely on people processing information, not rely on people fact-checking, but for example via social nudges support not sharing information, because that nudge would then trigger, for example, a social heuristic. And I can't show results of those two yet. That's what we're working on at the moment. What I can do is share a bit of a couple of results from a side project in which we sort of have extended that perspective, not on social media, but on sort of offline fake news. So we have been collecting fake news flyers that people have found in their letterbox. So that is a really bad pun. It's not fake news in the letterbox, but the picture shows fake news on the letterbox. It's an add-on study where we were examining printed or handwritten fake news posted in letterboxes. So that's also still ongoing. And we have looked at where there's themes and different which themes and topics are most prominent in those fake news or in those flyers. We're also looking at the sources and ideally where there is regional variation, but we're currently very much concentrated on Northern Germany. Currently, we've got 63 photos of different flyers. And I'm going to show you a couple of the topics that are evident on those flyers. This is a topic which we've called, it is sort of crucial information is withheld. So this shows, well, there's verschwiegene Todesfälle nach Corona-Impfung. So there's deaths after COVID vaccination that no one dares talking about. And of course, the statistics are doubtable. Then another topic that we find is the there is no pandemic. I really like the one on the right-hand side, which sort of shows you the differences between a real pandemic and the fake pandemic. So a real pandemic is one where everyone knows who's been really, really ill. And a fake pandemic, you know, really ill people, you only know them from the media. And the media, And a real pandemic is one where there's very many deaths. And a fake pandemic is where there's no excess deaths and so on. Also, I like the one on the left-hand side a lot as well, because it argues, well, that there's never been, the hospitals have never been overwhelmed. And if they're now closing hospitals, that shows hospitals have never been overwhelmed. So there is not really there is no pandemic. Another topic is the conspiracy. So the left-hand one is warning the population of the different alliances and the conspiracies from that are in place. And I really like the Great Reset one on the right-hand side. More recently, there's a lot of stuff on vaccination with the main argument, you're not eating gene food, but you're getting a genetic vaccination, and it can't be true. So usually it takes 10 years to develop a vaccination. This is far too fast. And you can see that there's two people on here, and there is the Mediziner und Wissenschaftler für Gesundheit, Freiheit und Demokratie e.V. This is one of the biggest sources of that kind of printed misinformation. And those two guys are on a lot of those flyers as well. The general motives of that is there is no pandemic and vaccination is bad for you. So you can actually order 1,000 printed flyers and distribute them in your neighborhood. So these guys, the Freiheitsboten, they are a major source of that kind of printed misinformation. But then there's also some homemade stuff and stuff that plays with motives of children. For example, on the right-hand side, wenn ich groß bin, werde ich der beste Denunziant im ganzen Land, because apparently children are supposed to dob in their parents if they're not adhering to COVID protection. And the left-hand side is particularly that is particularly interesting. Mama, du lässt zu, dass ich wenig Luft bekomme. Mama, du lässt zu, dass ich in der Schule friere. Mama, du lässt zu, dass ich nicht spielen darf wie früher. Mama, du lässt zu, dass ich wie eine Gefahr behandelt werde. Warum? Wenn ich groß bin, dann beschütze ich meine Kinder vor allen Erwachsenen. So that the treatment of children is also a big topic in those kind of printed misinformation. And the appearance, as you've seen, is a bit different from the appearance of things on social media, because there's more room. So these flyers provide sources, they provide some sort of graphics, they might even look a bit more serious than stuff that is being shared on the social media, which is more of like this one. So really, really quick one-liners and stuff. Okay, so this is to illustrate some of the social influences on adherence behavior by looking at stuff that happens on social media. I'm now switching towards a study that we have completed, or that we've recently completed. It's a pilot study for a larger study that we're going to start soon. It's a pilot EMA study on daily mental health and compliance with COVID behavior recommendations by Christopher, who has set up that stuff on CMR3. Very quickly, who has participated. So that was 91 participants, and they have participated in for 3 weeks, and we started recruiting in April 2020 and stopped the study in November 2020, on average 38 years old, and so on and so on. The important thing of the study design is down here. So we fired 5 daily random prompts. So there are 5 notifications every day where they were asked to respond to a very short questionnaire, and then there was 1 evening report. And as you can see, the compliance with the random prompts wasn't too fantastic, so less than half of those were completed, but a lot more of the evening reports were completed, so that's a good thing. What did we find? So in that study, we asked, or we got self-reported adherence to different behaviors over the day. And in the evening, we asked and we assessed indicators, in particular of mental health. And that's a random sample of participants out of that study, and their symptoms like anxiety, depression, and stress over the course of the study. So you see there's quite a bit of fluctuation in many of those. And then their self-reported compliance with the guidelines. And what you can see is that there's quite a bit of covariation going on with the mental health indicators and with compliance. So there's within-person covariation of that and compliance. We were also looking at momentary compliance, so looking at those random prompts, whether they reported being compliant during those random prompts. And what we find in those momentary assessments as predictors of compliance is if we see other being compliant, so if we see other people wearing masks, we're more likely to wear masks ourselves. Higher levels of perceived behavioral control, higher levels of perceived susceptibility, so high levels of personal vulnerability, and lower levels of momentary conflict. And conflict is assessing whether people perceived being adherent as being in conflict with their own personal goals at the moment. So if you perceive that being adherent is conflicting with your goals, you're less likely to adhere. If we're looking at day level, it's sort of getting a bit more complicated statistically, but bear with me, that is something that I find really interesting. So this is for the variable of conflict. As we have assessed at multiple times per day, we can compute within person, within day means of conflict. So we can assess, was that a day with more or with less conflict for that particular person? And we can assess variability in conflict. So was that a day where there were higher or lower fluctuations in conflict of that person during the day? And what we found is that both the variation and the means of conflict are negatively related to compliance. So if you have higher levels of conflict during a day, you're less likely to be adherent. That makes sense. But also, if you have higher levels, or if you have more variation in conflict, so if there's moments with high and moments with low conflict, so that change, if you have days like that, then your compliance during those days is lower as well. It gets better because that variation in conflict is also related to the effects of momentary predictors. So we found that yes, there are days with stronger or weaker effects. So we found that there are days with stronger or weaker effects of momentary predictors, and that depends on day level variables such as the variability of conflict. So the effects of perceived behavioral control on adherence, for example, are more perceived behavioral control, more compliant, not very surprising. But in particular, at low levels of perceived behavioral control, higher levels of conflict are related to particularly low compliance. This I find really interesting because that sort of suggests that in particular, those with lower perceived behavioral control are at risk, or put it the other way, if we can increase people's sense of control over those kinds of protective behaviors, then that level of conflicting with their goals is not as important. Very similar effects for the day level. So days with higher levels of conflict are also days where the effect of others complying are sort of different. In particular, if others are not complying, then if we have high levels of conflict, then we're less likely to be adherent. If we have lower levels of conflict, then that impact of others not being compliant isn't quite as strong. These are just some examples of that EMA study, which we find really, really interesting. And I'm now moving towards the end and give you a short outlook on the study we are planning and starting very soon. As I said, it might be a bit over the top to sort of sell that under macro level determinants, but I had to find an example here. It is a EMA study that is being supported by the Volkswagen Stiftung from Christopher and myself, and it looks at very similar determinants of adherence to behavioral recommendations and psychological adaptation to COVID-19 in everyday life. The idea is very similar to that pilot study. We know that there are between-person differences in responses to COVID in terms of mental health. We know there's between-person differences in adherence. We want to expand that with a perspective on within-person processes, so change over time, and look at dynamics, changes, and microprocesses in behavior cognitions, but also more contextual information, more social setting, and in particular, if there's socioeconomic differences in those within-person processes. And ideally, that tells us a bit more about who is particularly at risk of responding to particular cues in a particular way. And I've put that under sort of the macro level thing, because our idea is that we want to do that over a prolonged period of time. So the idea is to run that study over a period of 6 months, but with bouts of ecological momentary assessment. So we're not assessing people over the entire course of 6 months, but do 4-day bouts within those months. And that would allow us to sort of examine a relatively long period of time during which both the status of COVID legislation and things like those might change. So we would ideally be able to get some of that information into and examine that in correspondence with adherence. So I hope that sort of is sufficiently interesting to answer some of the warum ist es interessant, warum ist es wichtig, why is that interesting, why is that important questions. And as our university has put it wisely on a brochure for their 50th birthday, I've got to apologize, but I had to steal those things because it's so silly. Darum, that's why. I'd really like to acknowledge the support of a lot of people who are collaborating with us on that. So people from Bremen, people from Leeds, and people from Tasmania as well. And that's pretty much it. Thanks for bearing with me for so long. And I'm looking forward to questions and discussion.